And this hour, we're talking with Andrew Bashago about the Chronovisor, which captures images of the past and the present and the future. And we'll take your calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew, back around 2008, DARPA did what? They went out to solicit other technologies from other industries or what? What did they do?
Well, I think it's clear that they began contracting and then also allowing disclosure of the fact that they were going to be able to manipulate video images in real time, certainly as a result of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, at a much higher level of efficiency, be literally able to take a videotape of a crowd of people and use logarithms to determine what the images show rather than human intelligence analysts. So there's clearly been a revolution inside of DARPA as the principal agency that provides surveillance technology of this kind to the U.S. military, that we certainly, you know, our interests are advanced learning about this, the fact that to a lesser degree will our intelligence findings in support of military activities abroad depend on the vagaries of human judgment. That's probably a good thing, because when you use human intelligence analysts to look at images, clearly, you know, fuzzy logic enters in, sure. Bias enters in. So clearly there's been a revolution in the analysis of video images by DARPA that is in the interests of the United States, because we'll be able to actually derive intelligence findings of a very sophisticated nature based on recovering satellite images, for example, or video surveillance images that are taken in real time. I'm not criticizing that. What I'm simply noting is that DARPA was able to do that on a non-local basis 40 years ago. And so I have to ask, why is it constantly parading news releases of this kind, in which it brags about its automated surveillance technologies, and there's never any mention of the fact that 40 years ago it already had achieved the ability to capture moving video images of individuals doing things in what we call the past and the future?
Is there anything that could go awry here, Andrew? Anything that could hurt or alter an event because of this machinery?
Well, that goes to the sort of culture of secrecy that emerged around quantum access. When they realized that they were able to retrieve images of future events, clearly the individuals who were the technicians retrieving the images had to be sworn not just to secrecy, but they had to sign security oaths, for example, to not privateer based on knowledge of, let's say, what a particular company would do in the future. I mean, when you have knowledge of the ubiquitous success of a Microsoft in 1970, clearly you can become very wealthy as a quantum access technician, privateering on that kind of information. So inevitably, a culture of secrecy grew around the information. And when I was a child on the program, the individuals involved were so circumspect about not revealing events in my own future to me so as to not interpolate the future into the present and thereby alter the future, that sometimes it would even provoke anger among a project principal if something about one of the children's future was revealed to them in front of them. As a result of the project having some knowledge of some aspect of one of the participants' future. So when you retrieve information from the future and interpolate it on a real-time basis in the present, that always raises the prospect of a displacement occurring. And that's certainly one of the negative potentialities of Chronovision that goes beyond the concerns about privacy and so forth.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We'll go to our first-time caller, Stephen in Detroit. Hey, Stephen, thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Okay, I wanted to ask him, can he repeat about when he went through the hologram at 2013? Okay, what happened? And I wanted to know, in the scene, deja vu, the scene where they had took the picture of the young lady after the boat has blew up, and when Denzel Washington beamed that red light through the picture, could he explain that scene, and is that possible to do that? Okay, and is there a patent on this particular device? Could you, and I'll take the answer off phone.
Thank you. Can you help him out there, Andrew?
Well, what happened in 2013 is we were placed in these suits, and we were brought up to a chronovisor array that was huge. I mean, there were 40 or 50 individuals in the room, military brass, nurses, transcribers, scientists, engineers like my dad with their pen holders in their shirts. And we were actually fixed to a stanchions on the stage of the chronovisor because there was a fear that we would be lost if that was not done. In fact, when the light was turned on, I later found when they brought us back and I was walked off the stage disrobed and then brought into an intelligence briefing, and actually a debriefing that was conducted by a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, Office of Naval Intelligence, I could see that my father was no longer in the room, and I said, "Where's my dad?" And one of the team leaders explained to me he had to leave for a while and be by himself. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, he was upset." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, when we turned the light of the chronovisor on, you children all disappeared from the stage." You know, so my dad had the subjective experience of seeing his fifth child, his number three son, as he used to call me, literally disappear. And I'm sure there was a concern in the room that we had actually been lost in time. But we weren't. We were basically sent forward in time, and I experienced essentially hovering over the U.S. Supreme Court building like a diver would dive on a marine artifact, because the location and time space that they sent us was inundated. It was inundated by about 100 feet of brackish water. I could actually see bubbles coming up from the building. I could see algae on the columns of the U.S. Supreme Court building. And it wasn't in the distant future, when the United States no longer existed after some kind of major catastrophe. It was 2013. We actually cajoled that out.
Not far away.
Right. Now, in terms of deja vu, I'm not entirely sure of the scene that the caller is referring to, but certainly between 1970 and the present, with the whole revolution in laptop computer technology that we've had, certainly the ability to use Chronovision remotely at a base and then feed those signals to laptops held by people within the U.S. military and intelligence community, I believe probably has already been implemented. And then patents around these technologies, well, you have to remember that almost all disruptive technologies are classified. There are even secret math patents in the U.S. Government that the general public isn't aware exist. So my guess is that because the initial technology was developed by two Vatican priests, and then the Vatican approached the United States about taking the technology further, that as advancements were made, the patents that were granted were probably secret patents. Certainly the patents of Dr. Robert Beckwith may hold some clues in terms of the provenance of the technology as it evolved over time, because he was one of the principals on Project Pegasus who went on to be granted many conventional patents in electromagnetic applications.
All right, let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico now. Dave's with us on Coast to Coast. Good morning, David.
Hi. Good morning. I've really appreciate the show. I had a question about DARPA and the chemtrail or geoengineering spraying, if he saw any future events with that, because I'm telling you what, George, we are getting death dumped all day. We're spending $1 trillion a year paying a guy, a company called Evergreen Aviation, to just poison our butts, and they're killing the farmland. They've killed the honeybees. They're putting out all this fake information, and what most people fail to realize is the government is us, of the people, for the people, by the people. But when you start following the money, you find out that the Council on Foreign Relations has spent millions of dollars to, you know, discredit the geoengineering crowd, if you will, and just mix it up and put all the disinfo. You've got the Trilateral Commission, and you've got the Bilderbergers meeting next month in Switzerland. And they are going to continue to do this. And we need a revolution of people like Roxy Lopez to stand up and get the truth out, because we are getting poisoned. The bases.
And make sure, by the way, next hour we've got Michael Murphy joining us talking about chemtrails in his work. But, Andrew, I don't know if you know if they looked at chemtrails with the chronovisor.
Well, I certainly saw no images, no remote images of chemtrails when I was serving on Project Pegasus. I would note that DARPA, you know, is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So it certainly has had major involvement over the years by the nuclear physicists that we might call, let's say, the Los Alamos physics community. This the federal science administrator of Project Pegasus was Dr. Harold M. Agnew when he was the director of the Los Alamos National Labs. And one of, this is interesting in terms of the tie into Chronovision tonight, one of the consulting atomic physicists to Project Pegasus on Chronovision was Dr. Edward Teller. I was present at one of the Chronovisor setups in New Mexico where he was really literally just swearing in our presence as a result of the frustration he was experiencing trying to make one of the Chronovisors work. It was broken and he was trying to fix it. Now, the tie-in with Teller, of course, is that it was Teller's suggestion during a 1997 seminar that we begin spraying oxides of aluminum and barium mm-hmm. in the upper atmosphere to enhance the albedo effect of the planet to stem global warming and prevent a new ice age that led to the development of the chemtrail problem. And so there's a tie-in in that sense, and that is that one of the atomic physicists consulting Project Pegasus was, in fact, the progenitor of the chemtrail program, and that was Teller.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Ray is in Detroit. Hey, Ray, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Yeah, I had two questions. One was, when you went to 2045, I believe, is that what you said? That I was wondering, what did you see? And the other question was,
turn that down. Yeah.
Yeah. The other question was, what was it? This technology, by the time you said when 9/11 happened, were they able to actually view our timeline, or was what they were viewing before an alternate timeline? Because I know that's what you said before when seeing the future, it was alternate.
What was that timeline, Andrew? And I think you went out to 2013. You didn't go out to 45, did you?
Yes, I physically did. Teleported via a Stargate
teleported.
Device to 2045. I popped into view on a pedestrian plaza in front of a sort of immaculate industrial park with very beautiful emerald green and sort of steel-colored buildings. I could see somebody going by on a Segway. I saw no automobiles. And I saw no pollution, no congestion from automobiles. There was a balance between the built and the natural environment. This was a garden city of tomorrow. And we would then walk in, retrieve a microfilmed, basically a canister with a little cylinder of microfilm inside of it that we were ferrying back to the present. And so some of the remote image gathering that Project Pegasus achieved was not achieved via Chronovision, but by literally going forward in time to recover summaries that were being prepared of intervening events between the early 1970s and the 2040s. I probably did three or four of those jumps. We would then actually run against a wall inside of a conference room inside that building and then teleport back to the grounds of the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook Point, west of the Continental Divide sign there on Highway 160 in southwest Colorado. So, yes, I physically went forward in time, and we were recovering prepared images that were on conventional microfilm and then taking them back as well. They were using different ways of accessing information from the future, and that was certainly one of them. Regarding 9/11, all I can offer to that debate, very legitimate debate of what really happened, and what really gave rise to those horrific events in 2001, was that my father and I once drove down from Albuquerque after he had been called to the Aerojet Corporation facility in Socorro, New Mexico, where some of the film footage that we were taking back from the future was being processed. It was being processed under the direction of Dr. Sterling Colgate, who would go on to an illustrious career at the Los Alamos National Labs when he was the president of the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology. At that time, there was a building that was an Aerojet Corporation facility that was being intentionally misidentified on University of New Mexico New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology course catalogs as a student union of New Mexico Tech called Gibbons Hall. This is what my second fact-finding trip to New Mexico in 2004 revealed. In fact, that building was an Aerojet Corporation facility We had been down there several times previously on a project basis, but this time we were called down on an emergency basis. And as the technician explained, when we were let into the classified left side of that building, that Aerojet facility, they had gotten images of the event, of the domestic Pearl Harbor. And we were taken inside of a room where there were about 20 television screens, and we were permitted to view a film loop that captured about 20 seconds of one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers on September 11th of 2001, approximately 30 years in the future. So another reason I'm speaking out, I waited sort of for the dust to settle on 9/11 and the controversy surrounding it to come forward publicly and reveal that, yes, this particular Defense Department project for which Donald Rumsfeld served as defense attaché and who then went on to serve as defense secretary during 9/11 had remote images of the strike on the Twin Towers. I don't know what happened to that imagery. Again, it may have been placed in some storage cabinet in the Pentagon somewhere, but I think it is important to bear witness to that fact that this particular classified research and development project that Rumsfeld was not just consulting but literally attached to as one of the principals had images of the strike on the Twin Towers on September 11th of 2001, 30 years before the event.
Jeez. How many people tied into this project today? What do you think?
How many are on it now? It must be fairly sophisticated. There must be several hundred technicians. They clearly had developed by 1970 the ability to identify a particular person doing something at a particular time and place. This would be valuable in terms of law enforcement and preventing terrorism, having an understanding of threats to our nation and the world. But then again, there's the potential for abuse in which we would experience a total loss of privacy. So my guess is that the infrastructure within the U.S. intelligence community must number at least several hundred technicians who are accessing past and future events digitally, probably from their computer consoles at their desks.
With this information in hand, Andrew, do you think they could alter the events if they wanted to?
Yes, and that's another unexamined question that affects whether we remain a self-governing people. I mean, for example, if a particularly controversial political figure, let's say a John Lennon, was going to promote a particularly destabilizing political function, let's say a general strike, this kind of eavesdropping into future events would create a warrant for assassination of that person. So I think there are really profound, deep political questions that have to be asked regarding how this information is gathered and what purpose it's put to.
Those of you in the greater Los Angeles area, by the way, this Saturday, the so-called Judgment Day, Andrew will be in Los Angeles. You can get information on his website, Project Pegasus, that is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. But it's this Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific time in L.A. It's called the Olympic Collection. And I'll be back with more of your final calls with Andrew Bashago on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Michael Murphy joins us, flies in as we talk about what in the world are they spraying. So get ready for that. When we come back in a moment, we're going to take final phone calls with Andrew Bashago. Hey, by the way, for just 25 cents a day, maybe even a little less, depending on what you'd like to do with the package, you can become a Coast Insider, a Streamlink member. Just simply go to coasttocoastam.com and just find out what it all means. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Andrew Bashago. We're going to take your final calls here. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Brennan's with us on Coast to Coast. Brennan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good evening, George. I want to thank you and Tommy for putting on a wonderful show.
Welcome.
And I absolutely believe what Andrew is telling us, and it's very similar to what we heard from Dr. David Lewis Anderson on some of his past visits. My particular question, though, is about whether we could use the technology that he's talking about to go back and correct things from the past. On the 26th of February, 2009, my friend was on an ultralight plane that ended up crashing that night, my friend died hours later. I want to be able to communicate back to that day before the accident occurred and be able to undo what happened. Is that possible?
Well, there's two theories or models that explain retrocausation. One is that when you would go back to try to prevent the accident that tragically took your friend's life, when you did so, a new timeline would open up from that point forward in which he survived the event. And that's embodied in the model known as Schrodinger's cat. You know, when the cat right. both jumps in the box, and when the cat jumps in the box, another cat doesn't jump in the box. The other model is that you can only go back in time to complete an event. Because, for example, if you had come forward from the future to the present and intervened, you never would have needed to do so because the intervention would have already occurred and your friend would have survived. I adhere to the second model. Basically, I reject Schrodinger's cat because we went back and we apprised General Washington to conduct his retreat from New York Harbor. And when we did so in real time, and that event occurred. Another example of this is people say, well, the Gettysburg Address occurred, right? And you were sent back a second time and photographed. And I say, no. I was in the original event on November 19th of 1863. That's how I was able to be photographed the day that Lincoln gave his speech there. In fact, Lincoln can be identified in the crowd scene behind me on the dais in the so-called Josephine Cobb.
I remember
image of
that
Lincoln
picture.
At Gettysburg.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right, George, you put it up on your site when I last appeared. So I didn't revisit Gettysburg. I visited Gettysburg from the future when it first occurred. And that photograph was taken. So I think the empirical model that would obtain in your situation, I'm asked this question a lot, you know, can I go back in time and save a friend, a loved one, et cetera? You have to remember, when you go back from the future to your own past, you're visiting it as a time traveler from the future. So when you go back, let's say you went back at age 70 to correct some event that occurred when you were 7. Well, you don't suddenly become 7 when you time travel from the future as a 70-year-old. You visit your 7-year-old environment as a 70-year-old. So yes, you can go back in time and observe yourself as a 7-year-old, but you can't go back in time and become a 7-year-old. It's like any other journey. The environment you find is the environment you reach when you get there. It doesn't suddenly transform itself into the past that you were in as a 7-year-old. Because you're folding time back on itself. You're not transforming the fabric of time to reverse the chain of causation that followed that point in time that you seek to correct. So, sadly, my response to that conundrum is no. Mm. You could go back and warn your friend not to take a flight, but you couldn't suddenly become yourself in the past, and your friend wouldn't be interacting with you in real time. He would be interacting with you as a time traveler from the future.
You couldn't physically try to alter an event, for example.
Well, the legacy of H.G. Wells' Time Machine is the concept that when you're visiting the past, for example, that you're unwinding time. You're not. You're not going back in time. You're going through time. You're tunneling through to the past. So you don't. When you visit a previous age that you were at, you don't unwind your chronicle age and become that age you were in the past. You visit yourself as an older person from the future.
Let's go to Isaac, Buena Park, California, on the wildcard line. Hey, Isaac, thank you.
Hey, George, and hey, Andrew. Two points and two questions that I wanted to ask. One, how do we know we're witnessing these companies, these technology companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft, all competing and innovating? How do we know that these guys don't have access to this technology to give them an unfair advantage? I know the guy from Google, Vint Cerf, he's the chief innovation officer or information officer, and I know he worked with DARPA. How do we know he doesn't use this for an unfair advantage for Google? And also, it sounds to me like some of this technology might be like advanced video game type technology where you're like loading up worlds. Today you play a PlayStation 3 game and it's 3D. You load up the world from a disc. Maybe this is just a more advanced, like immersive type of loading up of a world.
Well, in answer to your question, in fact, we don't know whether or not technology transfer from the future is occurring and giving some enterprises an unfair advantage, basically allowing them to engage in unfair trade practice of interpolating future technical advances in their real-time products. And you raise a great issue. There should be greater scrutiny of what information from the future, what purposes it's being put to, and who it's being released to, because, in fact, there may be a program of technology transfer from our own future in which different technologies are being seeded in certain enterprises and then being carried forward in time. If that is occurring, it's clearly something that the public is not being made aware of, and also that private companies that are competing with such favored companies are not being made aware of either. So it's a great issue that you raise.
Let's go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Ralph's turn. Ralph, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hello, George. Hello, Andrew.
Hi there.
First-time caller, coast-to-coast insider here.
Super. And, thank you.
I have two questions for Andrew. First off, I want to say I admire your courage in bringing all this forward to the general public. And the first question I have is, have you contacted President Obama about your intentions of bringing all this out? And the second question is, do you know of anyone in the near future that may be coming forth as a whistleblower from the Project Pegasus? And I'll take the answers offline.
No, I'm
talking to you.
Okay.
I've been engaged in investigating my experiences on Project Pegasus since the late 90s. My truth campaign began in 2004 and in earnest in 2008. And I certainly haven't contacted the president regarding my plans of going forward with the information. I've been essentially trying to keep a low profile and come in under the federal radar. So contacting a president is always a very provocative act, and it's something I've avoided doing. I have described how I met Barack Obama briefly when I was a college student at UCLA in 1982, and it was stated in his presence that his friend and Mr. Obama knew to a moral certainty, to a factual certainty, that he was going to be president in the future. And they certainly didn't know at that time that I had spent several critical years of my childhood actually participating in the U.S. time-space program at the time of its emergence, and couldn't even imagine that they were saying something that I could make pretty deep sense of as somebody who had been in Project Pegasus as a kid. But no, I didn't contact the president, and I wouldn't. I don't think that any of these technologies should have remained secret this long, and he is certainly not responsible for the 40-year cover-up that has ensued. Regarding a whistleblower coming forward from the near future, I don't have the identity of a particular person, but there are many people who could come forward that I'm presently cultivating. Certainly the young man who lost his feet teleporting to Santa Fe is somebody that I think I may have identified. I think, in fact, he may have been on my team, and I didn't realize it when I saw him in his great distress after that tragic accident. I also recently spoke in Philadelphia at the Free Your Mind conference that Michael Austin Melton sponsored on April 9th and 10th, and there I met an individual my age who grew up in New Jersey at the time that I did. Actually, he was 3 years older, which would make sense because I was the youngest child in the project, being born in 1961, and he remembered meeting me at a military base in 1972 and confronting him in a hallway about why he wasn't saying anything to me. He explained that he had been told by the project sponsors not to talk to me. This was after I was identified as the principal whistleblower in the future, and I actually got angry and was yelling at him in the hallway, why won't you talk to me? So we compared notes on that incident, and as I speak out, I am being approached by individuals who were either in the project or can confirm some aspect of it. Another individual remembers and has identified the location and the instructor of one of the training programs that was connected to the project. So while I can't identify a specific person, a whistleblower, as it were, from the future coming back to our present to confirm my claims, certainly my truth campaign is beginning to cause people who I did meet or who were participants in some aspect of the project to come forward and contact me.
Do you feel that this grassroots campaign is growing for you, Andrew?
Oh, absolutely. At my most recent talk at Yelm, Washington, my lecture was attended by 1,250 people. And when I strode to the lectern and called for public teleportation, By 2020, those 1,250 people got up on their feet and started cheering. So there's a great desire in our country to really achieve two things. One is to correct the United States government, the functioning of our government, and place it on a basis of truth and of disclosure to the American people about its activities. The other thing I'm finding that there's a great public yearning for is to really purposefully go about the business of creating a new energy infrastructure, not just for this country, but for our planet. I mean, if we look at what has happened with the oil and nuclear paradigm that we're caught in, I mean, this year we've seen the befouling of the entire Gulf of Mexico and the nuclear contamination of a country, Japan. And so I think people understand that we need to evolve and launch a program to reinvent the energy infrastructure of our planet, move away from the fossil fuels into the new energy applications that our government has been in possession of for 40 years, and lead that effort internationally.
All right, next up we go to Wenatchee, Washington. Ron is with us, west of the Rockies. Hey, Ron.
Yes. You know, we live in a very skeptical public, Mr. Bisaggio, and I'm suspecting that most people probably are not buying this. Would you submit a lie detector test or possibly bring forth some more evidence? And also, I think that the truth does not have a price tag on it, yet you're trying to sell tickets to see you speak for $99.
Might I ask you which U.S. government agency you work for? I mean, if you're going to allege that I'm a liar and that I haven't brought forth substantial evidence, and that as a lawyer who has spent 12 years investigating the history of a secret U.S. classified research and development project that I was a participant in, that I don't have the right to speak publicly and earn a reasonable fee for my labors, then I'd like to make a false allegation against you and ask you who you're working for.
Well, I suppose you got to pay $99 to hear you talk. Just take a lie detector test, or nobody's really going to buy this stuff. You need to back it up.
Well, you're making a set of allegations that are false, and I don't feel I'm under this late in the game. After I've already established that Project Pegasus existed, I've done about 70 radio interviews now where I've revealed literally hundreds of facts about this program. I just think that you shouldn't operate on the basis of sour grapes and realize that one human being has defeated the entire U.S. Defense Department in making this information public rather than keeping it secret. So I'm not really going to endure your chastisement. I have a right to be paid for my labor. $100 isn't as much as you think it is. I mean, the last time I went out with a friend and got some sushi and had a couple of beers, the tab was $150. And so I don't really think your comments are fair.
Eat in Los Angeles, it'll be twice as big.
Well, yeah, and in L.A., you would drop $200 to go out and have some sushi and a couple beers with a friend. And look, I've spent about not only 12 years, but probably about $100,000 of my own money researching what happened to me. And that would both be in a direct money that I've contributed and in billable hours that I've lost as an attorney.
But he's got a right not to believe you.
Well, he's got a right not to believe me, but he doesn't have a right to call me a liar, or that somehow charging $99 for a five-hour lecture is extravagant.
No, not at all. Next up, we go to Washington. Rodney, first-time caller. Hey, Rodney, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey,
how are you?
Morning. Great. We'll get you in here.
I was just thrilled. Thank God for AM radio. I'm glad I went back to it. In the spirit of Art Bell, you do a great job.
Super.
I'd just like to say to the Mr. Bisaggio, you know, I have too many questions to ask in a little limited time, but based upon the scenario you presented about traveling back in time in the form and at the age and in the conditions, under the conditions that are prevalent in the present, does that entail the fact that the past exists all the time, that it's always present over and over again, that it's frozen in some way for access, for infinite access from the future? And as well, you already covered law enforcement, so I'll extrapolate very quickly. Suppose I'll pick the fact that the other gentleman who called and challenged the fact that you're revealing classified information and that it might be fraudulent. I don't buy into that. I think that you're certainly well-founded, and you know, I had to get up and turn my computer back on to actually do the research. I think that I guess I'll stick with that one question because I have so many of them I've written down. I'll try to catch you when you're in my area for a lecture, maybe ask you the questions then. But if this borders on science fiction or science fact, based upon some of the Googled articles I've read online, I certainly consider it to be science fact at this point. But have you been challenged by the intelligence community about revealing classified information? And
no.
Is the past always present for access from the, I mean, is the past always present for access?
All right. A minute to go, Andrew. Go ahead.
Right. Yes. In fact, the past isn't frozen, but multiple timelines that we would refer to as the past and future are occurring. They're flowing constantly, and we have to use technology to access those timelines. So they're not frozen, but they are there for infinite access, which is a beautiful term that you offer to the discussion of these issues. Science fiction versus science fact, I'm sharing science fact because, remember, everything that falls between what the public is being told, like this recent article regarding DARPA, and what the U.S. government has actually secretly achieved, all of that technology falls under the umbrella of official state secrecy. So this is science fact. I'm being very circumspect in only sharing what I know and distinguishing what I don't know. And so I'm not a science fiction scenarist. I'm a whistleblower regarding an actual classified U.S. research and development project. George, if I might just correct the website there on my tickets for the event in Los Angeles on Saturday. Tickets are available at www.projectpegasus.tix.com. That's projectpegasus.tix.com. And I'm at projectpegasus.net generally.
Okay, very good. Andrew,
thanks.
It's an incredible story. Appreciate
Thank you, George, and I really appreciate your support in enabling me to bring this important information to the American people. I think you've done a great service by helping me do so.
Well, let me tell you, it's an amazing story. Sometimes I feel like Robert Ripley, believe it or not, but that's your choice. Up next, Michael Murphy. What in the world are they spraying? We'll be right back.